Here's an interview I've been waiting to do for, well, going on 2 years now since I read a book called Intelligent Design. And very rarely do I remember reading books because I read a lot of books. This one I remember. I was sitting at the in the National Park at the base of the St. Louis Arch waiting for one of the trams to go up to the top. And this book had come across my desk, and I decided, okay, it looks very interesting. And I read the better part of it while sitting there waiting for the tram. And I was intrigued. Intelligent design, what exactly is this? It seemed to be an answer to Darwinian evolution and to other evolutionary views of the origins of life in the universe. But it seemed to be almost in a category by itself. Not entirely a new idea, but there was something different about this intelligent design. We're going to find out what it's all about in the course of this hour. My guest, Dr. William Dembski, author of the book Intelligent Design. He's also associate research professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture, and he's authored an article in a recent edition of the Christian Research Journal on intelligent design as well. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Dembski, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
What is intelligent design?
Well, it starts out really as a scientific research project where you're trying to figure out, are there ways to separate the effects of natural causes from intelligent causes? So let's say you're driving through southwest South Dakota and you see a rock formation that looks like Roosevelt, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Washington. You don't say, well, gee, isn't it amazing what the weather and erosion can do, right? There's an intelligent cause there. On the other hand, you go to Arches National Park in Utah, you have some funky-looking rock formations, but you say, well, that's natural causes. So how do you draw the distinction? Can you do that reliably? That's really where my work is focused, on the mathematics of reliably drawing this distinction between natural and intelligent causes. And if you can do that reliably, if you've got methods for doing that, then what happens when you start applying those methods to biological systems and you ask, are biological systems designed? And that's where things get dicey.
Now, it seems axiomatic that you look at, say, a human body, the anatomy of a human body. You see symmetry. You see the interconnection of various body systems, respiratory, circulatory, nervous system, lymphatic system, digestive system, all of them are interconnected, all controlled from one central brain. And you see what seems to be a system that the whole body is a system that reflects a designer. It's not a hodgepodge. It's not a patchwork quilt. How far can intelligent design go in answering questions about that design?
Well, I mean, what you've just described, I mean, it's certainly a very strong intuition that people have, that biological systems, the world as a whole, is designed. But what's happened in the last 150, 200 years is that a worldview known as naturalism has really come to dominate the scientific thinking. And the idea there is, if we can explain all this apparent design, because the word design is out there in the scientific world, but it's apparent design. I mean, somebody like Richard Dawkins will write, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of being designed for a purpose. But it's just an appearance of design. And the problem is, if you can explain something that looks designed without having to refer to actual design, if you can explain something by a natural cause, then you're not going to look for an actual designer. I mean, if you're a detective and you can explain why somebody died by accident, you're not going to look for a murder, you know. And so that's the thing. A design explanation, it's you give a natural cause, as it were, the right of way until you can definitively preclude it. And you see, and that's really the challenge for the intelligent design community, to show that these sorts of naturalistic, in the case of biology, Darwinian mechanisms, can't do the design work that the scientific community by and large claims it can do.
What does the scientific community that by and large holds to a mechanistic, a naturalistic, an evolutionary view of, let's just talk about that human body. When they look at the human body, what do they conclude in spite of what they call apparent design?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they will see the human body as the result of a long history, and it tends to be a divide and conquer approach. I mean, it's, you know, sure, you can't get the something as complex as the human body, it's not going to just appear spontaneously, but you can tell a long evolutionary story in which bit by bit this thing evolves, and where you keep adding complexity and folding it into the system. You get natural selection is going to improve the functioning of various parts, coordinate things together, and eventually you're going to get this, get the human body. But if you trace back the history, it's going to go, there's going to be, as it were, a seamless progression going back to some original single-celled organism. That's the story. If you don't have any sort of God or transcendence or design in the picture, that's really the only story you can tell. And this naturalistic, atheistic worldview is very entrenched in the scientific and academic communities. And, you know, even though it's, I think, a bitter pill, a hard pill to swallow, the naturalistic conception, there are lots of problems, lots of gaps in our understanding, in the scientific understanding, God, as far as they're concerned, is not an option. And so that's the tension I think they deal with.
The accusation that is made, in fact, it's explicitly made, and you deal with it in your Christian Research Journal article, is that you intelligent design guys, you have introduced an element of magic into natural causes. You're really talking about, when you talk about design at the beginning of creation, you're really talking about magic, something that we can't allow as scientists.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond?
Well, it's a common charge. I think the first thing to note is that intelligent causes do operate in the world, and that they do not, in many instances, presuppose any sort of magic or violation of natural laws or anything like that. I mean, here you and I are communicating, exchanging information. We're intelligent causes at the end of receivers. Where's the miracle? They're intelligent causes. They're operating in tandem or in conjunction with natural causes. There's no violation of natural laws going on, no miracles going on. I think this is where I think the people opposed to intelligent design keep trying to push it. Well, you're really talking supernatural design. The distinction is not between natural causes and supernatural causes. The distinction is between natural causes and intelligent causes. And the reason that's the proper distinction to draw, is because natural causes, the way the scientific community has defined it, really since the rise of modern science in the 17th and 18th century, is as causes that do not have any sort of purpose, intelligence behind them. It's chance and necessity. That's what the scientific community has come to mean by intelligent causes, by natural causes, rather. So, the fact of the matter is also that many special sciences already presuppose intelligent causes. And there's no appeal there to supernatural or anything like that. I mean, the whole SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, used to be funded by NASA but is now privately funded. You couldn't get that program off the ground if you didn't have a sense of intelligent causes there. I mean, they're fundamental. I mean, if you're going to be monitoring the night sky or monitoring the sky for radio waves that are indicative of intelligent causes, you've got to have a sense of what are these intelligent causes and how can you separate the radio waves that would tell us that we're dealing with an intelligent cause from those which are just naturally produced. And if you saw the movie Contact, the radio astronomers there assumed that they could tell that distinction. In fact, in the movie, there was this key scene where contact is established, where they know that they're dealing with an intelligence, and it's because they're getting a long sequence of prime numbers. Prime numbers are numbers divisible only by themselves in one, and so that convinced them that they were dealing with an intelligence.
I think about archaeology as a science.
Right, that's another example.
A man walks up to a mound, and he sees a few stones sticking out of the level ground, and he thinks he can discern maybe a circle there. And he starts to dig, and he realizes these stones are actually the top of a few stones stacked on top of each other. And then he realizes at the center of this circle there's some charred bone, there's some ash and things like that. And he says to himself, somebody must have built a fire here. no scientist would say, wait a minute, why don't you consider the possibility that those stones naturally occurred in a circle stacked up with a fire in the center and bones? No one says that. Is intelligent design just basic good science?
I certainly think it is. I mean, it's we're looking. Intelligent causes have causal powers that natural causes don't have. Natural causes are just too stupid to do some things. If you look at take a Scrabble board with Scrabble pieces. Natural causes can strew those pieces on the board, but they can't arrange them to form some sort of meaningful message. Okay, and so it's a fundamental distinction, and we use this all the time in, you know, I mean, intellectual property law, insurance fraud, you know, forensic science, data falsification in science, all sorts of disciplines and areas couldn't get off the ground if we didn't have that distinction between intelligent causes and natural causes. The problem is that within science, intelligent causes are not something that starts the show going. It's not that you have an intelligence that's responsible for the world and then the world is this expression of an intelligence. Rather, intelligence is, as it were, an afterthought of an evolutionary process. You have this mindless evolutionary process that goes, that chugs along, and out pop intelligent beings like ourselves at the end of that evolutionary process.
Now that sounds like magic.
Well, and it is magic, you know, and then that's actually what I've argued, that if you want to, you know, the real magicians are on the evolutionary, the Darwinian naturalistic evolutionary side.
All right. How far does intelligent design go? This is a personal concern of mine because when I read the book, I came across explicit passages in the book Intelligent Design where you're pretty quick to warn this is not theistic creation just dressed up in scientific garb. Explain
right.
That term.
Well, the thing is this, okay, a doctrine of creation is always a doctrine about the source of being of the world. Where does the world come from? What's the source? What brings the world into existence? All intelligent design can tell you about is it looks at the arrangement of matter, or arrangement of mass energy, arrangement of pre-existing stuff. Okay, so take the example of a carpenter. A carpenter takes existing wood and fashions it into a piece of furniture, but the carpenter is not responsible for that wood in the first place. Intelligent design, if you're an intelligent design researcher looking at, let's say, a biological system, you've got a system that's made out of particles, you know, molecules. You can break it down further into atoms and elementary particles, but, you know, it's made out of stuff, but it's arranged in certain ways, and that arrangement conveys certain patterns and tells you that it's intelligently designed. Okay, so there's an intelligence behind it. But where did that stuff come from in the first place? That's what a doctrine of creation tells you. And so intelligent design can look and determine that there's an intelligence behind things, but it can't tell you, you know, what is the nature of that intelligence ultimately? Is that intelligence the creator God? And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, that's just fine, because it just means that intelligent design is, it's a scientific program. It's a modest program. It's not trying to do too much. There's plenty of work to do theologically. And certainly as a Christian, you know, I'm going to look at the design in biology and say, well, that design is due to the Christian God. You know, but that's a separate move. And I think, in fact, this has been a problem historically in what's been called natural theology, that people and Christians have looked at the design in the world and then immediately jumped to the Christian God. And in doing that, they've really mixed up their science and theology rather than keeping them separate. And I think there's value to keeping them separate.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. William Dembski on intelligent design. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. So intelligent design can tell us about the cause, but not the creator. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
In recent church history, one of the church's most vocal advocates has also been one of the church's most vocal critics. He lived and worked in Germany during the Third Reich. He died in a Nazi prison camp, executed at the order of Adolf Hitler himself. He was Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. William Dembski is my guest. He's author of the book Intelligent Design, The Bridge Between Science and Technology. He's associate research professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and senior fellow for the Discovery Institute Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture. And we're talking about intelligent design. Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Dembski, let me get this straight then. The real concern of the intelligent design community is not so much with promoting creationism, but with answering the faulty, the poor science of Darwinian evolution. And it's concerned more with cause than with creator. Am I correct there?
Well, I think its implications are vast, and I think it does have great implications for creation. But I think it starts out as there's a positive and negative aspect. The negative aspect is where it is a challenge to Darwinian evolutionary theory, saying that it's inadequate. It cannot account for biological complexity, the complexity that we see. And then also carving out a positive research program for understanding what's the effects of this intelligence in biology and trying to get a fruitful research program going. Now, the thing is, though, that is going to have tremendous implications, especially in Western culture, where Darwinian evolutionary theory has been used as a whip, as it were, to keep Christians and theists generally at bay. So I see it as having apologetic value in the sense that it clears the ground for a lot of things that just prevent people from even considering the claims of Christ and the gospel.
Half of the Christian apologetic is polemic. It is destroying the smug satisfaction of the cynic and of the skeptic.
Yeah.
And it sounds like intelligent design is, forgive the pun, designed to do this.
Well, I see it. My own view is not that apologetics argues you into the kingdom, but rather that it gets rid of obstacles, things that stumbling blocks, things that prevent one from considering the claims of Christ.
Agreed.
I mean, the thing is, if you buy into a naturalistic worldview, that nature is all there is, that we understand the world as a seamless web of unbroken natural causes, there's no place for the incarnation or anything that's theologically meaningful. So you've got to clear the ground there. Now, I say, that's, I think, the apologetic value, but that's not what ultimately drives the program. I think ultimately what drives the program is the search for truth. I mean, God has created a wonderful world. What sort of world has he created? Is it a world in which the design that God has put into the world is detectable, where we can get a handle on it and do science with it? Or was God a master of stealth who just covered his tracks, and where our science cannot tell us anything about God, and where all our knowledge of God has to be based on a pure leap of faith?
Okay? I
opt for the former, that the design in the world is detectable and that we can do science with it.
Now, I'm put in mind of St. Paul, where he writes about natural revelation. What can be detected of God by observing God's handiwork, if you will, apart from salvation, apart from special revelation? And one of the aspects of God that he describes there is his wisdom. In other words, his intelligence, his ability to intelligently design a world that we can therefore detect his fingerprints in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, I find that very congenial, and, I think intelligent design matches up with that really nicely.
How is this different? An accusation that might come from the creationist camp is, well, intelligent design is really little more than just a reclad theistic evolution.
Well, I think there's some that doesn't really. I mean, that sort of criticism doesn't hold up. And in fact, I find that the creationists of all stripes, old Earth, young Earth, progressive, seem by and large to be quite happy with what's happening with intelligent design. But theistic evolution, usually when it's used, I mean, it's the term is used to refer to a view in which on the scientific end, it's that the scientific view, the Darwinian view, is basically correct. So it's basically Darwin got it right, and that's the way God did it. Okay, I mean, just to encapsulate it. And that's not what we're saying. We're saying Darwin did not get it right. Now, within intelligent design, there are a lot of different positions. I have a colleague named Mike Behe who does hold to what's called as common descent or common ancestry, so that he does hold that there's an evolutionary process that connects a single-celled organism all the way up to humanity. He thinks that there's good evidence for that. There are other colleagues of mine, like Paul Nelson, who thinks that there are a lot of separate creative acts. So, and all of that falls within intelligent design because the issue is not what is the historical process, but was there an intelligence actively involved and indispensable to the biological complexity that we see, however it got expressed there, whether through a long evolutionary process or through a number of discrete creation events. And either in any position in between, as long as it's treating intelligence substantively, it's saying, look, intelligence is indispensable for understanding and scientifically understanding the complexity that we see in biological systems, that's a huge challenge to Darwinian evolutionary theory, because the Darwinian view is a purely naturalistic evolutionary view. It's saying that it's just a blind evolutionary process. No intelligence, it's just natural selection, random variation, working together over a long historical process is sufficient to account for everything that we see.
Now, I'm trying to envision the retort of someone who is, you know, fully steeped in naturalistic causes and evolution. And they might say, look, we have the fossil record. We have what appears to be a continuum of development of species. And we have a likeness of anatomy from species to species that is sometimes uncanny. Granted, we don't have any missing links, but we have very close to these missing links. How do you account for that according to intelligent design?
Well, again, I pointed out to my colleague Mike Behe, who would say no problem with evolution, but you still need an intelligence there. Now, I'm tending more toward the there are some separate creation events, and there's no bridging the gaps, especially at the level of high levels of classification like kingdoms, phyla, and classes. So, I think the problem with something like the fossil record, you know, what you have is you've got all this data, and it's certainly there are lots of gaps there, and there's a lot of conflict even within the paleontological community about just what this signifies and the degree to which there are evolutionary relations. And somebody like Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge have put forward a theory called punctuated equilibria some years back. And the problem is, that there is not this seamless connection of organisms one to another. There are lots of gaps.
Let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll let you finish your answer to that question. Dr. William Dembski is my guest. I also want to know about those who say, look at the way some of these animals are designed. No intelligent designer would put an animal together like that. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues Etc.
Cavemen, now were they primitive?
Answers with Ken Ham
author of the popular book Combating Racism called One Blood. Now, Ken, this time I've got two questions for you. First, do you believe in cavemen? And second, if you do, were they really the primitive beings we often see pictured in some evolutionary books?
Well, in answer to your first question, yes, I do believe in cavemen. But I have a very simple definition of cavemen. They're men who live in caves. And there are people today who live in caves in various places around the world. But do I believe these cavemen were primitive beings? Well, not at all. Do you know what's fascinating? Evolutionary scientists have indoctrinated people to think that cavemen used stone tools to tear up meat and then probably burned it over an open fire. But in Japan, scientists discovered evidence of cavemen who actually built ovens. And as the scientists said, they showed a high degree of sophistication in preparing their food. The researchers even went on to say that using stone ovens allows a person to cook more delicately without charring the meat. So these cavemen certainly don't sound like primitive creatures to me. Who were they then? Well, after the Tower of Babel, people spread out over the earth, and some of them began living in caves.
Do you think there might be intelligent life in outer space? Actually, the Bible has a lot to shed on this intriguing question. Read Ken Ham's free booklet on extraterrestrial life when you log on to our attractive and easy-to-use website, AnswersRadio.com.
Good evening, I'm Tony Hicks with AM850 KFUO weather and traffic. A cool down tonight. Tonight will be clear and 65 will be the overnight low. Tomorrow mostly sunny with a high of 85 right now. Sunny and 82 degrees. We'll look at traffic. Southbound 270 after Highway 40. Traffic heavy as you head towards Manchester. Then it's slow just south of Gravois all the way to 55 and continued slow on eastbound 255 from 55 to Telegraph. And northbound 55 at Weber Road. The construction crews are out there and that right lane of traffic is going to be closed until 7 p.m. That's a look at weather and traffic.
Well, we're having a lot of fun giving away the new VeggieTales video, The Ballad of Little Joe, on AM 850 KFUO. You'll have another chance to win this new video cassette for your family tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. We'll also have fresh commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer and feature our CPH Book of the Week and give away a few product samples on the Wednesday Morning Show with yours truly, Paul Clayton, on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. My guest in this hour, Dr. William Dembski. We're talking about intelligent design. He's written this book called Intelligent Design, The Bridge Between Science and Technology. He's also associate research professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Renewal of Science and Culture. You can join us with a question or a comment. The phone number, 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Dembski, I had to interrupt an answer you were giving before the break. You had said that there isn't a seamless fabric in the fossil record. Please go on.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of paleontologists will admit that there are problems explaining it. But then, you know, how do you make sense out of it? And I think this is a problem in science. When you have a lot of raw data, you know, it's just there. And scientists confront the same raw data. But then what sorts of patterns do you see there? And a lot of that depends on what sort of working theories you're going to bring to that. So if you have a Darwinian theory, a naturalistic worldview, there's no place for design in that. You're going to get that data to fit those patterns. And it may not be a very neat fit, but you're going to get it to, you know, make the best sort of fit you can. From a design perspective, it seems that you're not going to be able to account for the fossil record as some sort of, in Darwinian terms, where there's this gradual evolutionary process. And what you see in the fossil record, and people like Stephen Jay Gould, who is a naturalist, not a strict Darwinian, but a naturalist, is going to say that what you've got basically is you've got sudden emergence and then stasis. Basically, you've got organisms that come on the scene, they suddenly appear, and then they stay largely unchanged until they, either to the present day or until they go extinct. And that's that's not very Darwinian, and that's what the fossil record indicates.
Okay. Another objection is what's called suboptimal design. It's an objection to intelligent design. They say an intelligent designer would not design certain animals that just seem ill-fitted toward their very existence. They seem hampered by certain physical, you know, attributes of their anatomy or something like that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there's several issues which need to be teased apart. I mean, for one thing, the question of optimal design is a separate question from design as is, right? I mean, in fact, nothing that humans design is probably optimal. I mean, the cars that rolled off the assembly lines in Detroit in the 70s were not optimal, and I think that's why the Japanese were able to do as well as they did. They were still designed. You know, there's no question that they were designed. So the suboptimality objection, I think it gets its traction because people automatically think, well, this designer has to be the Christian God with all these perfections, you know, and so he's got to do things perfectly. But that doesn't necessarily follow. I mean, it's a messy world in which there's conflict, in which things are not, you know, where not all the I's are dotted and T's crossed, is a world where perhaps certain moral training can take place, which can't take place in a perfectly antiseptic world. I mean, so, you know, but notice this sort of rationalization that I've just given. I mean, it's a theological sort of justification. And immediately when one starts asking these questions of optimality, one tends to get into theological discussions. As a colleague of mine, Cornelius Hunter, who's written the book Darwin's God, which I encourage the audience to get because it shows that this sort of optimality concern really tends to always merge into some sort of theological concern. But I think another thing worth keeping in mind is that a lot of these suboptimality objections, when you actually look at them, you find that the design actually is superb. Let me just give you, I do a lot of public speaking, lecture on a lot of college campuses, college and university campuses, and almost invariably I get the question of what about the inverted retina? Okay, so you've got it turns out when you look at the eye, the mammalian eye, the human eye, the nerves and what you have is the instead of the retina being in front of the whole blood supply, it's actually the blood supply is in front of the retina. It's sort of blocking. It seems to block the light that's coming in. And you know, it's commonly said, well, that's just stupid design, you know, because it's blocking the light. But it turns out that in fact the retinal cells have require the most oxygen of any cells around, and they need that blood supply. And if you're going to get the best combination of resolution, sensitivity, and speed, especially sensitivity, because when do the retinal cells need that the blood supply? When the light is low. I mean, you've got retinal cells that can fire with a single photon. So it's an amazing instrument. And so design always requires trade-offs. And I would challenge anybody who wants to say that the inverted retina is suboptimal, design something better. You know, I think this is, you are dealing with design problems. But when you want to say it's suboptimal. The problem with design is always that you're dealing with real systems and there are always going to be trade-offs. And I think it's very hard when you actually press somebody who's making the suboptimality objection, it's going to be very hard for them to show how they could actually improve it.
Well, here's another objection that I think is raised. It's a little more philosophical, but I think the average Joe can understand this, but how would the average Joe answer this? You know, design, it's really just a product of our minds. We are pattern perceivers, even where patterns don't exist. I look at the clouds, I see a bunny. That doesn't mean there was an intelligence making that cloud look like a bunny. All the design that you claim to be perceiving is just really a product of the way the human mind is structured. How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think what you need to do is you need to run that intuition a bit further. I mean, okay, you've got a cloud formation and you see something that looks like a bunny, but if you see a skywriter, or you don't see the skywriter, but you see, you know, Eat at Joe's written in very distinct letters, you know, in the clouds, it's absurd to explain that in terms of natural causes, okay? So, you know, go to South Dakota, and see Mount Rushmore or to Stonehenge in the UK, you're dealing with design objects. So yes, I mean, there is a problem that sometimes we read patterns into things, but there are also patterns that are objectively given. And in fact, that's what you're describing there has been the center of my research as a mathematician, separating the types of patterns that reliably point us to design. I call those specifications, and distinguishing them from these sorts of, imposing the patterns after the fact on the clouds, which I call fabrications, and doing that in a mathematically and logically rigorous way. And so, I think the intelligent design community does have an answer to that.
Another objection might be, well, this is really sounds like a one-size-fits-all explanation. It explains too much. It's too neat. Everything is attributed to intelligent design.
Well, that doesn't really follow. I mean, it turns out that these design inferences, when you try to apply them, that they are hard-won inferences. I mean, they do not apply to anything, because what happens is actually natural causes are the default position. Intelligent causes end up being the explanation of last resort, as it were. And so, so you give the benefit of the doubt to the natural cause until you have good reason for defeating it. And so it's not the case that you would explain everything by design. I mean, it's true, you can look at an ink blot. It could have happened that an inkwell just fell in an earthquake or by some natural cause onto that sheet of paper. It could be that somebody deliberately poured that ink on the sheet of paper. But if all you have is circumstantial evidence, you don't have the video camera running, you didn't see that person do it, for all you know, it was a natural cause. But if you see, a coherent message written in English on that sheet of paper, at that point you cannot attribute this to natural causes any longer. The chemistry and physics of paper and ink cannot account for, that configuration of ink on paper. And that's what we're always dealing with design. There are configurations of matter, mass energy, physical stuff that cannot be reasonably attributed to natural causes. Some of it can, okay? But it's not an all-size-fits-all. These are hard-won inferences, and we do give the benefit of the doubt to natural causes.
You mentioned before the book Darwin's God. I interviewed its author some time ago. I concur in recommending this book because it's key to understanding where Darwin's what was behind his need to drive toward naturalistic evolution, and it really was, in fact, his expectations of what God must be like. And it's a great book to read. I've also interviewed others on the question between evolution and creation in particular. And many of them have pointed out that if one wants to speak in terms of just probability, as you said before, necessity and chance, we simply, no matter how old you make the universe, you still can't make it old enough to get where we've got today. Is that a good answer to these things?
Well, I think what's behind that question is, how many opportunities or how much time is there, how much stuff is there by which we could try to explain the complexity we have in the world in terms of some sort of chance or chance-driven process. There's an old view which goes back to Epicurus, a philosopher before Christ, who saw the world as infinite in duration and extent, and he saw—I mean, he had a crude sort of evolutionary story of how the world and how life came about. It's just that when you have an infinite amount of time and stuff, all combinations of stuff will eventually recur, and some of those combinations are going to be stable and be living, and those that aren't stable will not be repeated. So you have there's a crude evolutionary story, but it's when you have infinite stuff that you can get away with that. But our best science is telling us that the world is actually a very small place. It's only about 12, 14 billion years old. the observable universe has maybe 10 to the 80, 10 to the 90 elementary particles. Not much stuff there. And, you know, I know there's been a conflict between young Earth and old Earth creationists, but 6,000 years, 6 billion years, it's not enough time to get the sort of complexities that we see with biological systems. You know, so it's let me just follow up on that. It's an interesting move that's now happening in the physics community is you've got physicists who are arguing for what they call many worlds or inflationary cosmologies. And the idea there is to try to get back to Epicurus's where you've got all this additional stuff, all these different additional possibilities for chance to succeed. You know?
But then again, is stepping out of the realm of science into pure speculation.
Yeah. Well, you know, a common objection to intelligent design is that it's a god of the gaps, that somehow we're invoking God or a designer to do the work of a natural cause. But the same charge can be leveled against people who invoke chance, I mean, a chance of the gaps. I mean, if you allow, you know, unrestricted use of chance, you can explain anything also. You know, you could say, well, how did you write this essay? Well, I flipped the coin, let heads be one, tails zero, organized it into eight-bit blocks, treated it as an ASCII character, and it came out as this wonderful essay.
You know? It's kind of like the monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters argument. When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation on intelligent design with Dr. William Dembski. Some of these things are just counterintuitive, aren't they? They're just counterintuitive. And we'll take your phone calls as well, 1-800-730-2727. Stay with us.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on why he's a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Well, first of all, I'd like to explain why I'm a Christian pastor. And that's simply because our faith has the strongest historical and archaeological credentials of any of the world religious systems by far. It's based on fact and not on myth. Specifically, I'm also delighted to be a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because we believe that Luther's teachings best reflect both Holy Scriptures and their interpretation in the early Christian church. Our church holds true to those teachings without wavering, while at the same time sponsoring great educational programs as well as a worldwide mission outreach.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172.
Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with Dr. William Dembski, author of the book Intelligent Design, about intelligent design. Dr. Dembski, I notice in the bio at the end of your Christian Research Journal article, it says here, usually it just gives basically the credentials of a person, but this one says, he expects to see intelligent design supersede Darwinism by the time he reaches retirement in 2025. Is that a reasonable expectation?
I think it is. You know, it was kind of a cheeky comment, but I figure, you know, I may as well fly my colors.
Is it true? You think it's true?
I think so. I think it's. I think we're seeing the tremors there already. I'm finding that the arguments on the other side, I find that they're running out of steam. And I think on the other hand, the intelligent design community, it's one research question and project leads to another. I think there's an incredible dynamism that I'm seeing there. So I think it's going to happen in an age of the Internet where ideas flow so easily. You know, and as you said, actually, at the end of our last segment, you know, counterintuitive. I think Darwinism is counterintuitive. In fact, you have to be educated into it and out of your fundamental intuitions about design. I think what intelligent design is doing is giving substance to those intuitions, showing that you can do science with them. And I think that's going to be very powerful for a younger generation. And I think it's going to happen.
Folks, if you've got a question or a comment to make on Darwinism, on evolution, or on intelligent design, you can give us a call, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. 2727. You teach college students and deal with the college community, with the university community. You say you lecture and speak publicly. My perception is that most of the young people entering college have been fairly well taught a foundation of naturalism, of Darwin's theory of evolution and its broad implications for the origins of the universe. They got the basic parameters there. How are they receiving what is the answer to that in intelligent design?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's that simple. I mean, I think there's certainly the academic textbooks, high school, junior high, and before that, I think they're going to be imbued with a naturalistic worldview. But you've got also a Christian culture. You know, even, you know, however much we want to say it's been watered down or whatever, it's still there. And when you look at, you know, Gallup polls about what do people believe, you know, in terms of creation and evolution, it's been consistent for about the last 20 years that about 45% of the U.S. population believes in creation in a stricter sort. So, you know, special creation of human beings. Another 40% or so, or 35%, believe in some sort of God-guided evolution, but only about 10% are the strict Darwinian naturalists. And you know, so it's so you know, when I've taught, I always have a lot who do have that sort of Christian heritage, some sort of belief in a God in their background. You know, so there is that, but then you are also dealing with, as you say, those that have been pretty thoroughly indoctrinated. But you know, it's you know, I think a lot of people are watching this to see when is intelligent design really going to draw some blood. You know, I mean, you can think of it sort of as a, you know, people used to have these badger baitings, right, where you'd have dogs and they'd be attacking a badger, and I think the badger is this incredibly strong and tough beast, you know, and that's Darwinism right now. But once the dogs draw blood, you know, then they go to town, and I think that's what's going to happen to Darwinism. I mean, think of what happened in the 60s when you had, you know, the rebelliousness of youth, you know, rising up against, you know, what was considered the stodgy conservatism of you know, the older generation. Well, Darwinism is the status quo right now, you know, and I think you're going to find a younger generation that wants to take on this stodgy old worldview. And this is an information age. Intelligent design is actually, I mean, when you formulate it theoretically, you can formulate it as a theory of information, which is tying in right into a lot of our intuitions about the web, the internet, all of that. So I think just even rhetorically, intelligent design is in a position to win the hearts of students, college students, university students. So I'm very optimistic. You know, some may think I'm deluded, but you know, time will tell.
Kurt's calling from his car phone. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question is: do you see a new generation of outstanding scientists coming out of the homeschooling and Christian school? The schools and that sort of education, because in the public schools, as I recall when I was there, it's dogma, it's don't ask questions, and that certainly is not a good hothouse for breeding scientists.
Well, good question.
I don't know. I mean, it's I've got actually two research assistants living with me. They both they've graduated college. One was homeschooled, one was not. And both are very sharp. They're going on to doctoral studies, one in philosophy of mind at a school in Temple University in Philadelphia, the other in biology at the University of California, San Diego. One was homeschooled, and as I said, the other was not, but both very sharp. I think there's tremendous opportunity with the homeschooled kids. I mean, I think they've got some tremendous advantages. But I think there's also, if you've got kids who are going to the public schools but who are inoculated, who are reading the stuff by colleagues of mine and, you know, worldview sorts of materials, James Sire, David Noble, and others, you know, I think they can be inoculated and actually even come out stronger because they've had to deal with this sort of naturalistic indoctrination, and by resisting it, I think they're that much stronger when they go on to college and university. So I've got hope on all sides. I don't think it's, you know, it's just, well, our hope is with the homeschooled and, you know, the those who are going to the regular schools are in for a real problem. I think the crucial thing is that we need to be equipped, you know, and reflective and know what the enemy is doing.
To that end, with only about a minute to answer, I think you can do this. The best argument against evolution for a layperson to make when challenged on something like this?
Well, the best argument. I don't think there's any real soundbite. I you know, I'm sorry about that, but I think what you have to do is you've got to inform yourself, and it's you're dealing with a whole worldview, a naturalistic worldview. C.S. Lewis put it in at the end of his book Miracles that it's like an infection; it gets in our bones. And what you've got to do is you've got to educate yourself. You've got to read the materials. I mean, you can't just say, well, there are gaps in the fossil record. And because the Darwinist is going to interpret it in one way, the intelligent design person in another way. So it's, you know, read my books, read Phil Johnson's books, read Mike Behe, read Cornelius Hunter. You know, inform yourself.
Dr. William Dembski, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You know, intelligent design has provided something for me, at least, because I've been uncomfortable with the notion that we should be teaching creationism in public schools. Because I don't want public school teachers teaching just some sort of general creationism. That's going into the realm of theology. Okay? But what about intelligent design? What about saying there are two different views of where everything came from? One says it's all the product of chance and necessity, and the other one says there's intelligent design. I think that alone would better equip not only our children, but all children in schools for answering the fallacies of evolution and for giving them at least something else, some other explanation for what happened, so that when the evolutionist comes up and says, so what do you say about the fossil record, they don't just have to stand there with their mouth hanging open. They can say, you know, let's talk about design. It's not creationism, folks. Don't get your theology from intelligent design. Get your theology from the Word of God. Learn that God did indeed create the world in 6 days by the very speaking of his voice. But when we're in the realm of public ideas with the evolutionists, intelligence design makes a very, very good tool. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Information is available from Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past.